Hello, Safar Adim. The history of this group within the Jewish fold has been unfolded before you. Permit me, though, perhaps, take a moment or two to rehearse it for you so that all of us may be clear of whom we speak and of the people whose history we are going to attempt to describe. Jews came to Spain early in Roman days. They remained there through the greatness and then the decline of the Roman Empire. They remained there when the barbarian tribes supplanted Rome. And under both the Arian Visigothic kings and under the Orthodox Visigothic kings, Jewish communities continued to grow and to flourish in the Iberian Peninsula. But the truly great period of Spanish Jewry, the period which stamped them as a unique group, began in the year 711. For it was in 711 that a Mohammedan general led the forces of the Crescent across the Straits of Gibraltar, and in 10 short years quickly freed the peninsula of its Christian rulers. Then for several centuries, the Jewish people of Spain flourished culturally, economically, politically, under Islamic rule. And even in the 11th and 12th centuries of the Common Era, when the Christian reconquest began, and slowly but perceptibly and surely, the kingdoms of Castile and Aragon began to spread, first from their bases in the Pyrenees southward, the Jews continued to enjoy what was, for the medieval times, a period of relative prosperity. By the middle of the 13th century, the Christian kingdoms of Spain had displaced the Mohammedans in all but the southernmost section, and the Jews continued to flourish and their civilization and culture to prosper. But as Christianity completed the task of the reconquest, Jewish life took a turn for the worse. Beginning in the 14th century, there were a series of terrible persecutions, riots, pogroms, and the like. 1391, and 1415, and 1417, and 1465, and 1484. And finally, in the year 1492, the Jews were given the choice between baptism and exile. Now, these 8 centuries under Islamic and Christian rule, as a great Jewish community, had developed for the Jews of Spain certain unique customs, practices, life attitudes, habits. And when the Jews went into the long, hard roll in exile, whenever they took it, they carried with them the imprint indelibly on their souls of this Spanish experience. So that whether they settled in Italy or in the Ottoman Empire, which then comprised the Aegean coast of Greece and Turkey and Palestine and Egypt, or whether they settled along the Barbary coast in North Africa, or whether they went later to the Canary Islands and to the New World and to Holland and to England, these peoples continued to practice the ways which their ancestors had practiced under the rich sun and the pleasant air of the Spanish skies. They carried with them Spanish folkways. They retained the Spanish language, the Castilian, which they called Ladino. Often they would send delegations to Spain to see how the ancient synagogues of Toledo and Cordoba were built. And if you were to visit the Sephardic congregation in Sofia, Bulgaria, you would see that it is an exact reproduction, stone for stone, archway for archway, of the ancestral great synagogue of Toledo. And so these peoples deserve the title of Sefaradi, of Spaniard, because though they settled in 4 continents and 100 countries, they retained this Spanish imprint, and it marks them off as a community within the body of the whole of Israel, but yet a community apart. I would like to take as my point of departure this evening an attempt to describe for you the distinctive attitude towards life, what the Europeans would have called the Weltanschauung, the feeling that these people impressed wherever they went, their attitudes towards life, towards birth, towards education, towards morality, towards death, their joys and their recreations, their sorrows and their tribulations. I do not propose to go into the deeper realms of their philosophy, their science, and their teaching, but simply to try and make you see them as people, to help you put flesh and blood upon the bare facts of history. Now this is, I realize, no easy task. Not only are we dealing with hundreds of thousands of people who lived through 12 centuries of human history, but we are dealing with a group which, like every other group which has ever existed, has included rogues and saints, the carefree, the careless, the dedicated, the concerned, cynics and believers, realists and the tormented. So all I can do is not to give you in particular an impression of individual Sephardic Jews, but to paint for you an overall picture, to show you something of the heart of these Spanish Jewish communities. And to do so, I'd like to try an experiment. After all, these institutes themselves are, in our temple life, an experiment. I would like to let the Sephardim speak as much as possible for themselves. In addition to the learned tomes, the weighty books which they have inscribed for posterity, we have, from the pens of the Sephardim, personal letters, diaries, chronicles of the events which were occurring in their day. We have a few record books from their kahal, their community organization. And above all, we have their poetry, for it was in poetry that these people stand preeminent. Some of their poetry is stylized, formalized. But a great deal of it breathes a freshness, a warmth, a full-bodiedness which enables us to see into the windows of their soul. And so, bearing in mind that all this poetry must be presented to you in translation, and bearing in mind that much of the style in which these people wrote is inevitably archaic and dated, I still think that perhaps the best way of making you see the Sephardim as people will be to try and let them, as much as possible, speak this evening for themselves. So if I seem to be reading from a few more papers than usual, bear with me. I simply cannot memorize all of these quotations exactly. Before we begin, I must insist on one other thesis. You know, we tend to take our religious labels lightly. Being Jewish in America does not distinguish us in our cultural life, in our professional life, in our political life. At most, it distinguishes us in our religious worship, public, and in the observance of holidays and perhaps of dietary laws in our homes. But our norms of conduct, our personal relationships, our responsibilities as citizens, all these are universal, or at least are as broad as the boundaries of our American polity. This was not true of the Sephardic Jewish community, either in Spain or almost anywhere else that the Sephardim went. Being Jewish, being a member of the Jewish community, was the most determinative and distinctive thing in their lives. In the Mediterranean world, especially under Islamic rule, there was no such thing as a central government whose justice, whose law, applied equally to all men. There was a ruler, the caliph, but he delegated rule over the various religious groups that comprised his kingdom to responsible individuals from each of those religious groups. And so there was a Jewish nasi, or a Jewish gaon, or an exilarch, who was responsible to the court for the peace and the well-being and the taxes of the Jewish community. And the same was true of the Christian communities and of the Shiite heretic Islamic communities, the Zoroastrian communities, and the like. Each religious group retained its distinctive religious code of law. Each religious group was allowed to govern itself as long as the peace of the kingdom was observed and taxes were regularly paid. This meant that the law which the Jews had developed in biblical days, which had been continued in Talmudic times, was the norm of Jewish behavior. This meant that the Jew in his everyday actions, as far as what would be governed today by our criminal courts and our civil courts and our courts of equity, our domestic relations courts, was subject to Jewish law. And so Jewish ways of life, Jewish habits of thought, Jewish traditions had inevitably a much greater impact and impress upon the average Jewish personality. And if you have ever wondered why it is that our ancestors, hard-headed, realistic people that they were, seemed to spend so much time studying the Talmud or studying the religious codes or studying the legal sections of the Bible, it was simply that because these texts were the code of law, the code of practice which they put into their daily lives. It was as important and vital to them to be studied and to be developed as are any of the digests of law or the histories of law in our modern day. So in addition to worship, to ritual, and to practice, Judaism was distinctive, was the coloration by which the Jews of Spain were known, and it was the label which separated them from their Islamic and from their Jewish neighbors. The synagogue was much more than simply a house of worship and a house of study and a house of sociability. It was the central governing body of that particular community in Israel. Here, the court met, oaths were administered. Here, an individual could come to air his private grievances against another individual. Here, the rabbi sat as a court of appeal, a court of last resort. Here, the community voted its charters, its basic laws, its proportionate taxation. In short, the synagogue was much more than it is for us in our more modern times. Now, since the Sephardic Jews were governed by a code of law unique to themselves, and since this impressed upon them the stamp of their Jewishness much more than it is impressed, say, upon us, it is well to remember that what we consider the traditional patterns of Jewish life were their daily living, patterns of daily living. But we ought to strip from our minds some of the stereotypes which have come to us about ghetto living. The Sephardic Jew rarely was forced to live in ghettos. Only in the last few years of his stay in Spain, and only in the rare and unusual community outside of Spain, was he forced to live in a ghetto by church and governmental decision. Rather, he lived in what was known as a Juderia, a Jewish quarter. He lived there by choice as much as by compulsion, very much the same way that we live in certain quarters of the city rather than, say, on the west side. It permitted him to visit about, to be neighborly, to take an active part in the Jewish community. And there was another reason, and that was a reason of defense. The Middle Ages were turbulent days. Not only was there rampant religious persecution, but there was endemic revolt. Always some feudal nobleman was rising up against another or against his liege lord. Times were difficult and riotous. The highways between communities were filled with bandits and ruffians. The town life was rough. Thieves and the like often walked the streets at night. And the Jewish community, as did all the religious communities of Spain or elsewhere, banded together for self-protection and sometimes so that they could police their own quarters. And indeed, the synagogue served the additional function of being the last fortress, the final point of refuge of an attacked or persecuted Jewish community. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Newport and seen there the beautiful colonial Sephardic synagogue that was built in 1768 and is now a national shrine. But if you have, you will notice that still here in this first, this only Sephardic synagogue, original Sephardic synagogue, which still exists in America, there is evidence of the purpose of defense to which a community synagogue was often put. Because directly in front of the bima, of the central altar, there is a trap door and a tunnel. And this tunnel leads from the sanctuary of the synagogue across several streets and out into a back alley. So that if the people there were ever attacked by ruffians or a mob, they could retreat to the synagogue, defend themselves as long as possible there, and then escape through this unexpected avenue. The sanctuary of the synagogue was often literally that. It was the most strongly built of all the buildings in the community. It was generally built on a promontory or height, and so was easily defensible. And time and again, the chronicles of medieval Jewry tell of a Jewish community forced to retreat into the synagogue, there putting up its last defense against a mob. I have said that these were tumultuous times. I would like to quote from a letter written in the 11th century from one Jewish community in Spain to another, in which they asked that the next community be charitable to a wanderer on his way to a pilgrimage in Palestine because of certain facts, unexpected reverses which had taken place in his life. I think that these reverses were not unusual in the day. We wish to inform our brothers about Mr. Reuben, the son of Isaac, who comes to us from the city of Rodez in the Pyrenees. This man, Reuben, was once a very wealthy man. He possessed silver, gold, and landed property, but he fell into the traps of the evil men of his country and he became their victim. One day he sent his only son with his servants to work in the field. Suddenly they were attacked in the forest by rude Christian bandits bent on destruction. They killed the son and the servants beside him. This became known to the father, and he found the dead son in the forest, but there was nobody near who could help him. Overwhelmed by this catastrophe, the father broke down and fell into despair. He then appealed to the governor of his district, but the latter did not reply because they were Gentiles and he a Jew. And the governor even became his enemy when he saw this man's misfortune. He robbed him. He deprived him of all of his property and threw him aside like an empty vessel. He said to him, "You are an old man and have no son. I shall therefore now take possession of your whole fortune." The father, isolated and in despair, left that place on a pilgrimage and has so far come as far as us. It was hard to make a living in those days. Some became prosperous, but that point at which the reversals in life begin was much more dramatic and much more prevalent and much more the expected in life than, of course, we can, in our rather secure age, imagine. I insisted upon the fact that the Jews did not live in a ghettoized existence because neither culturally nor politically could they behave like a ghettoized people. Dr. Israel Abrahams, a noted English author and scholar and researcher in Jewish history, has compiled a list of the documented professions engaged in by Jews in Spain. I'd like to quote to you part of that list, simply to show you its variety, to show you that the Jews of the Sephardic communities were as much a part of every level of business, professional worlds of their communities as we are, say, in our own. This is the first half of the list. Many physicians, carriage dealers, I suppose there are modern automobile salesmen, clerks, cloth merchants, produce dealers, lion tamers, jugglers, bankers, tailors, professional soldiers. It's strange to realize that for two centuries, the King of Aragon had a special crack Jewish regiment of 15,000 men who were his special bodyguard. Ships captains and navigators, upholsterers, I suppose they would be our modern decorators, jewelers, apothecaries, major domos, pawnbrokers, farmers, teachers, actors, troubadours, perhaps unexpected profession, butchers, and makers of scientific instruments. It was not easy then to earn a living. Some men made great fortunes, but others found that they had to grub. They had to work at 101 jobs simply to eke out their daily existence. We have a very amusing and somewhat ironic little poem left to us by one of the keenest minds of Spanish Jewry, Abraham Ibn Ezra, in which he tells us of the difficulties under which he earned his livelihood. "'Twas sure a luckless planet that ruled when I was born. I hoped for fame and fortune. I have but loss and scorn. An evil fate pursues me with unrelenting spite. If I sold lamps and candles, the sun would shine all night. I cannot prosper no matter what I try. Were selling shrouds my business, no man would ever die." And there's a similar catalog of business woes by an Italian, Sephardi Leon de Modena, who lived 26 ways in which he unsuccessfully tried to earn a living. By teaching Jewish pupils, by teaching Gentile pupils, by simply teaching anyone who wanted to know how to write, by delivering sermons, by writing sermons for others, by acting as a cantor, by acting as secretary of charitable and other societies, by officiating as a rabbi, by giving decisions in ritual law, by officiating as judge, by daily lessons in the synagogue, by conferring rabbinical diplomas, by letter writing, by composing music, by composing verses for weddings and tombstones, by translating Italian sonnets into Hebrew and Hebrew sonnets into Italian, by writing comedies, by producing them, by drawing up legal documents, by translation, by printing my own writings, by proofreading, by teaching the writings of charms and talisman, by selling books of charms as a commercial agent, and when all else failed, as a matchmaker. I think we will agree that he had his difficulties. But I think we'll also, in this catalog of occupations, see the varied experiences possible for a young man who simply couldn't settle down. Now, there were among the Sephardic Jews, as we might expect in any community, status professions, and those which were sort of looked askance. The physicians, the teachers, the rabbis, who were in those days also judges, these were of the status group. But it's well to remember that these communities had their amateur theatrical societies, their professional operetta groups. In fact, we have been left a rather amusing 14th century analysis of the characteristics and the personalities of a prima donna. If we've been reading the reports of Maria Callas, we can understand perhaps some of the feelings which this gentleman, a certain Joseph Ben Meir Ibn Zabara, felt about the Bohemians and the actors and the singers of his day. He wrote this to his son: "Beware of singers. They are mostly thieves. Trust no words of theirs, for they are liars. They dally with women. They long after other people's money. They fancy they are clever, but they know not their left hand from their right. They raise their hands all day and call, but know not to whom. A singer stands on the platform, raised above all other men, and he thinks he is as lofty as his place. He constantly emits sounds which mount to his brain and dry it up. Hence he is so witless." They worked hard. Times were always insecure. A family fortune could be made and as easily lost. They were in danger of competition from privileged guilds. They were in danger of the enmity of Christian nobles. They were in danger of confiscation by royal power. And yet throughout these years, they continued actively to pursue their vocations and their crafts and their businesses, all types of businesses, for the centralization of Jewish life into financial activities, into pawnbroking and money lending and the like, which sometimes took place in the backward communities of Eastern Europe under compulsion, never took place among these people. Throughout their history in Spain, you find them as vineyard keepers, as farmers, as herdsmen, as craftsmen of all type. They were among the most able and artistic of the silversmiths and the jewelers of their day. And they were often sought after by the rich, the noble, who wanted some specially fine work done for them. Now, as the ghetto walls did not exist for them professionally, so intellectually and culturally, the Sephardic Jew was open and aware of all the secular and humanistic knowledge available to him in his day. Education was definitely parochial. It centered on the religion, on the learning of Hebrew, on the mastering of the sacred texts. And yet it was never so myopic, so ingrown as to prohibit a knowledge of the Greek philosophers and the Greek and the Egyptian and the Babylonian scientists and physicians. Nay, these were encouraged. And among the great intellectual leaders, the great rabbis of Spain, later of their Sephardic confreres, you will inevitably see wedded in the same man deep piety, deep learning of tradition, and a profound insight and understanding of the secular sciences. Sephardic Jewry had little truck with superstition, with all the common forms of religious misinformation and ignorance, although, of course, many among the simpler folk must have believed. I wonder if we today could not still take heed of the admonitions of Maimonides when he wrote to the people of his own day, "Do not believe the absurd ideas of astrologers or soothsayers who falsely assert that the constellation at the time of one's birth determines whether one is to be virtuous or vicious, the individual being thus necessarily compelled to follow out a certain line of conduct. We may not practice divination as do the heathen." What is divination? Here is an example. A person says, "Because a piece of my bread dropped from my mouth, or my stick dropped from my hand, I shall not go today to a certain place, for were I to go, my business could not be transacted. Or because a fox crossed on my right side, I shall not go outside the door of my house today, for if I were to go out, a deceiver would meet me." So also the man who makes omens for himself, saying, "If such and such a thing happened to me, I will do a certain thing, and if it should not happen to me, I will not do it." All these are the false and fraudulent notions with which priests of old used to mislead the ignorant masses in order to exploit them. It is unthinkable that Jews who are of a higher mental caliber should succumb to such superstitions or see the slightest validity in them. All men in wisdom and culture know with absolute certainty that superstition, divination, astrology, each explicitly prohibited by the Torah, is nonsensical and appeals only to the weak-minded. I wonder what we'll say next when we toss some sugar, some salt over our shoulders or worry because a black cat has crossed in front of our paths. One of the important functions which this educated Sephardic community played in the development of Western civilization was its role as the bridge between the superior culture of the Arab and the nascent culture of the Christian world. The Jew spoke Arabic. The Jew was familiar with the Arabic translations of the great Greek physicians and scientists and philosophers. The Jew often knew these works in their original. And as the Mohammed did not make the transition into the Christian world, the Jew did. And here in this new Christian world, he translated for the benefit of his own community and for the benefit of the Christian community most of the great texts of this superior Islamic civilization. It was by means of Jewish translators that the works of Aristotle and Plato and Hippocrates and Galen and Avicenna and Ibn Rushd first became known in the West. The Jew translated them for his own purposes into Castilian, into the Romance languages, into Hebrew. But they'd also served the other purpose of making the West aware of the knowledge of the East. And if you have studied the history of culture, you know that between the 11th century and the 13th century, this new culture infused into the West permitted it to grow rapidly and to break out of the Middle Ages and ultimately made possible the Renaissance and our own modern world. If you have want knowledge, the monks used to say, go to the Jews. They were aware of all that was happening in the world about them. Now philosophy, the knowledge of philosophy, is not always an unmixed blessing. Those of you who have suffered with a young man who is undergoing his first exposure to freshman philosophy will know the doubts, the skepticism which it can often breed. And all the medieval religious communities at one point or another became worried that philosophic knowledge would breed heresy, would breed heterodoxy, would breed disbelief. In the 13th centuries, both the great world civilizations of Islam and of Christianity were convulsed by major conflicts which raged within, by pietistic fanatics against those who felt that philosophy must be studied wherever it led. In Islam, the pious won the day, and Islamic civilization was never again to know its primacy, to know its advanced ideas that it had held up to that time. In the Christian world, the pietists also held the day for a long time. Aristotle was burned in the middle of the 13th century at Paris. The Dominican orders censored education at the universities, but ultimately those who believed in free access to all thought would slowly open the doors of the Christian mind to the knowledge of the Greeks. In the Jewish community, there was also a major struggle between those who believed in piety and fundamentalistic attitudes towards religion, and those who believed that philosophy and the secular sciences must be prosecuted wherever they led. But it was on a much more gentle scale. Oh, there were acts of regrettable excess. But for the most part, the Sephardic Jewish communities rejected any and every attempt by a fanatic minority to impose restrictions, to impose censorship upon the study of philosophy by those who were prepared for that study. The battle was joined over the dissemination of the philosophic works of Moses Maimonides. A man named Solomon ben Abraham of Montpellier attempted to enforce a ban against the study of philosophic works such as this in all the Sephardic communities of southern France and of Spain. Much debate ensued. In general, he was unsuccessful. We have a letter by one of the moderates in this battle, written in 1304, which I think best expresses the Sephardic awareness of the importance of reason and of philosophy, and yet of its potential limitations. There is a modern air, I think, to the few lines that I'd like to quote. I admit that there are some detestable ideas expressed in the philosophic writings, but this does not justify your refusal to make ourselves acquainted with the good ideas they contain. Our scientific efforts provide evidence to the nations that we have an open mind and are prepared to understand anything which makes for the good and the beautiful. By such a procedure, the convictions of a people are by no means undermined, at least not ours. For the truth which we possess, free inquiry offers the best proof. Besides, there is nobody among our followers who wants to dissolve all the biblical stories into allegories. I do not overestimate the value of philosophy, neither do I underestimate it. And I am thankful to anybody who can give me a satisfactory explanation of one of the great natural phenomena. And this must be said, that throughout their history, the Sephardic Jewish communities have never out of hand rejected any of the scientific or humanistic knowledge of their day. Indeed, they have been open and eagerly aware of it. Now, what did these people see life to be? You know, if you would analyze the sermons given from this pulpit, you would see that over the years they deal basically with the political and economic tensions of the day, but also with certain recurring themes, the problems of child raising, the problems of marriage, the problems of maturity, the problems of understanding life and the world about us, the problems of facing old age, disease, and death. What did the Sephardic Jew see life to be? The first thing that must be said in this score is that he was a realist about life. He was not blind to its limitations. He was not unaware of its possibilities. There's a beautiful poem by Abraham Ibn Ezra, which presages the great soliloquy in Shakespeare on the seven ages of man, in which one of these Sephardic minds sees life, touches on many of its problems psychologically, and I think expresses ideas which we would not find outdated or naive. Perhaps you will bear with me while I quote it to you. Let but the son of earth remember from his birth that in the end he shall return as at his birth he was, so shall he be. Arise and prosper. Say ye unto him of 5 years, whose desires rise up apace like the awakening sun or regions dim. He has his mother's breast for resting place and moves not, his father's shoulders for his chariot. Yet in the end he shall return as at his birth he was, so shall he be. How urge ye him of 10 years with intent towards instruction? Yet a little space and he will grow and find his chastisement. Speak unto him with tender tone of grace. Joy shall he rouse for them that bear him, for his father's house. For in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. How sweet the days of him of 20 years. Swift as a hart he leaps to and fro over the hills and scorns reproof, nor hears the voice of teachers, but a graceful doe, goodly and fair. This is the portion for him and his snare. Yet in the end he shall return as at his birth he was, so shall he be. Adolescence was a problem even in those days. At 30 years into a woman's hands he falls. Rise and look on him and see. Behold him now caught fast within the strands. The arrows pierce him round. The want shall be now of his life only the wants of children and of wife. But in the end he shall return as at his birth he was, so shall he be. He wanders forth subdued, who shall attain to 40 years. He runs his way, behind the light companions of his youth remain. An evil be it, or sweet, yet shall he find joy in his lot, firm by his work, his charge forsaking not. Yet in the end he shall return as at his birth he was, so shall he be. The days of vanity, days nothing worth, remember he of 50 years. And mourns because the days of mourning come. And earth and all the glory of the world he scorns, bearing the fear lest his own time intended be drawing near. For in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. Ask what befalls when 60 years are his. Then have his muscles grown like root and bar set to his work, sufficing but for this and rooted, that they bend now but so far, and never they shall move again to rouse him to the fray. For in the end he shall return as at his birth he was, so shall he be. If into 70 years his life way wends, His words are difficult to hear. 'Tis his fate now to go unheeded. Now upon his friends only a burden, he becomes a weight especially to his own soul, and on the staff that bears him to his goal. For in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. At 80 years, then is he but a care upon his sons. His heart is no more his, nor his thoughts with them. Only he is there, scorned of his neighbors, yes, his portion galled to the brim, and wormwood is the morsel now for him. For in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. And after, he is even as one dead. Happy the man who deems his own part that of a stranger who has quickly fled, who has no contemplation in his heart, nor thought, nor sense, but his soul's afterlife and recompense. For in the end, he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. I think with the exception, the fact that old age, in those difficult times and lacking the knowledge of geriatrics which we have today, with the exception that old age was undoubtedly much more difficult and painful, much of the problems of their life are our problems, certainly many of the psychological adjustments which each decade places upon us were theirs as well as ours. The Sephardic Jew was a warm-blooded person. There was nothing puritanical in his makeup. He didn't believe particularly in aesthetic practices, in monastic asceticism. He knew that he was given life and that as much as possible, within the limits of moderation, should be enjoyed. And he created a body of nature poetry, the first great body of such poetry since the Bible itself, one of the most thrilling of his artistic creations. He saw life in all of its beauty, and he loved to report this beauty and share it with the beauty of words. It was almost spring, so I chose as an example of his nature-loving poetry this sonnet by Judah Halevi. It's called "The Earth in Spring." Then day by day her broidered gown she changes for fresh wonder. A rich profusion of gay robes she scatters all around her. From day to day her flowers' tints come change quick, like eyes that brighten, now white, like pearl, now ruby red, now emerald green they'll lighten. She turns all pale from time to time, red blushes quick or cover. She's like a fair, fond bride that pours warm kisses on her lover. The beauty of her bursting spring so far exceeds my telling. Methinks sometimes she pales the stars that have in heaven their dwelling. He was warm-blooded in his appreciation of nature and in his wants in life. Those of you who know the Rubaiyat will recognize perhaps some of the spirit of this little stanza entitled "The Joy of Life." A beautiful woman, a cup of wine, and a garden, the song of birds and the sound of murmuring waters, these are the balm of a lover, the joy to the sad, welcome to the stranger, wealth to the poor, and healing to the sick. He knew how to laugh at himself, the foibles, vanities, at the pomposities of the world about him. Listen to this 14th century advice to boors, and to bores, rather. "Go not too frequently thy friends to see, lest they grow weary of the sight of thee. When rain is scanty, then we pray for more, but we do not love a continuous downpour." And in my station in life, I can appreciate this little stanza. "I spied a white hair lurking in my beard and straightway plucked it thence. Thou art brave, it sneered, gainst a lone scout, quite brave. But wilt thou be as plucky when my troop comes seeking me?" Sometimes love of life leads to excess. He loved expensive things. He loved to dress himself and his women in beautiful brocade and embroidery. He loved the sport. Gambling, games of chance were not altogether unknown in these communities. The dandy was as much a problem then as it might be today. A gentleman by the name of Menachem ben Judah Lonzano, 15th century Sephardi of Italy, spoke of those who love to preen themselves with clothes. My glory, honor, all depend upon my shirt and cloak and hat. Alas, an age that honors clothes, though worn by horse or ass. Life was a series of rich experiences to this person, to this Sephardi. Not all of them were enjoyable. Many were trying, many were difficult, many were painful. But like our people in all ages, he especially enjoyed intellectual challenge. He enjoyed to exercise his mind in keen competition with another good mind. In Cordoba in the 14th century, they had to set up a series of restrictions in the synagogue which prohibited public debate of crucial issues within the sanctuary itself, because the prohibition read, "Those who get started seem never to know when public worship has started and it is time to stop." They loved to play chess, much as we do today. Abraham Ibn Ezra has left us in rhyme form a series of instructions on the game of chess. Let me read to you simply the first few lines and the last. "I will sing a song of battle planned in days long past and over. Men of skill and science set it on a plane of 8 divisions and designed in squares all checkered. 2 camps face each one the other, and the king stand by for battle. And twixt these 2 is the fighting, bent on war the face of each is, ever moving or encamping. Yet no swords are drawn in warfare. They are known by signs and token, sealed and written on their body." And then after he has described a complete game of chess, he says, "Should a king in the destruction fall within the foeman's power, he is never granted mercy, neither refuge nor deliverance, nor a flight to refuge city. Judged by foes and lacking rescue, though not slain, he is checkmated. Hosts about him all are slaughtered, giving life for his deliverance. Quenched and vanished is their glory, for they see their Lord is smitten. Yet they fight again this battle, for in death is resurrection." The Sephardic Jew governed his matrimonial relationships by adjustment between families, generally without concern to the wishes of the young couple. Marriages were set by the adults. Often the young people who were married seemed, by our standards, to be mere children. But marriage, of course, was often completed for a young couple or established for a young couple who had fallen in love with one another. Love poetry is not unknown to the Sephardic Jew. Often a fixed set marriage blossomed into love, as often a young couple were able to cozen and to badger their parents into permitting such a marriage. I do not know of any collection of poetry of love as rich and as stimulating as that of the Spanish Jew since the days of the Book of Songs and of Songs from our own Bible. We have this little sonnet by Judah Halevi. "Awake, my fair, my love, awake, that I may gaze on thee. And if one fain to kiss thy lips, thou in thy dreams dost see, lo, I myself then of thy dream the interpreter will be." They show in their poetry a great deal of awareness of the subtleties of love and of relationships between suitor and the person being sought. Think of the sophistication of these few lines. Into my eyes he loving looked. My arms about his neck were twined. And in the mirror of my eyes, what but his image did he find? Upon my dark-used eyes he pressed his lips with breath of passion rare. The rogue, 'twas not my eyes he kissed. He kissed his picture mirrored there. Sometimes, as always in the history of man, love went unrequited. With hopeless love my heart is sick. Confession bursts my lips' restraint. But thou, my love, that thou, my love, dost cast me off, has touched me with a death-like taint. I view the land both near and far. To me it seems a prison vast. Throughout its breadth, where'er I look, my eyes are met by doors locked fast. And though the world stood open wide, though angel hosts filled every space, to me 'twere destitute of charm didst thou withdraw thy face. And as is the way of men, the abandoned, forsaken lover often sought to assuage his woes with wine. And as always, he found that he sought a solace which was not to be his. With heavy groans did I approach my friends, heavy as though the mountains I would move. The flagon they were murdering. They poured into the cup wild-eyed the grape's red blood. No, they killed not, they breathed new life therein. Then too in fiery rapture burned my veins, but soon the fumes had fled. In vain, in vain. You cannot fill the breach of the rent heart. Ye crave a sensuous joy. Ye strive in vain to cheat with flames of passion. So when the sinking sun draws near to night, the sky's bright cheeks fade neath those tresses black, my despair. Ye laugh, but silently the soul weeps on. Ye cannot stifle her sincere lament. A great deal of poetry has been written about the blessings of marriage, the happy and long period of being together. I know of no more beautiful summation of a marriage than this epitaph, which was found on a tombstone in Toledo. The wife has left this for her husband, whom she predeceased. Remember the covenant of our youth, and knock at the door of my grave with a loving hand. One of the unique concerns of Sephardic Jewry was the concern with blood, with ancestry, with lineage. They undoubtedly took this over from the nobility, whom they in so many ways tried to ape in their actions. But Sephardic Jewry, more than any other Jewry which has ever existed, loved to trace its ancestry through many generations. And an impoverished family was often prouder of its ancestry than it would have been had a child been able to marry wealth and position. This is not always a noble concern. It can be overdone. Indeed, it was overdone by the Spanish Jew, because he often felt himself to be of a superior stock, as it were, than the rest of the Jewish community. Often the noble line families of the Sephardic Jewry would not even intermarry with other less blooded Sephardic Jews. Generally, when they lived outside of Spain, they refused to intermarry with the European Jewish community. And most unfortunate, sometimes the bad blood developed between these communities. There is, for instance, a record in France. When in 1789 the revolution seemed to promise equality of citizenship to all Jews, A delegation was sent from the Sephardic Jewish communities of Bordeaux and Bayonne to the Estates General, in which they pleaded before the Estates that they were the true sons of Jacob, and that the German Jews who inhabited Alsace-Lorraine were of inferior stock, inferior blood, and inferior in every way, and that they should not be confused one with the other. It was fine for the Estates General to free and give equal citizenship to the Sephardi, but not to the Ashkenazi. In time, of course, their numbers dwindled, and inevitably their pride had also to dwindle. But probably the least laudable feature of the unique attitudes towards life of this people was this concern with being well-born in the sense of having noble ancestors. Now, the warmth of life, love of life, which was evidenced by these Sephardic Jews, spilled over into their relations, to their faith, to their God, and to their people. As we have seen, he was at home in poetry. Indeed, no other group of Jews except the psalmists of old and perhaps the authors of our own day have done as much to enrich the liturgy of our synagogue with beautiful anthems and hymns and expressions of the soul. The familiar Yigdal, the Adon Olam, the Lachad Odi, the Shalom Aleichem, which we sing almost every Friday night here at our chapel services, all these were hymns indited for the first time by able, feeling, believing Sephardic poets, by the very same poets who wrote the poetry of love and of love of nature, which we read earlier. Their poetry was simple, because the Sfaradi used a pure, crystal pure Hebrew. His thoughts were precise. The meter was complicated. The organization of the poetry often highly stylized. But the thought and the sense was piercing, brittle in its insistence on getting to the point and stating the exact point to be discovered. When all within is dark, former friends misprize, from them I turn to thee and find love in thine eyes. When all within is dark and I my soul despise, from me I turn to thee and find love in thine eyes. When all thy face is dark and thy just anger rise, from thee I turn to thee and find love in thine eyes. Or this beautiful hymn, which is still sung during the worship of our Yom Kippur. Lord, thine humble servant here, suppliant now before thee. Our Father, from thy children's plea, turn not, we implore thee. Lord, thy people, sore oppressed from the depths, implore thee. Our Father, let us not this day cry in vain before thee. Lord, blot out our evil pride, all our sins before thee. Our Father, for thy mercy's sake, pardon, we implore thee. Lord, no sacrifice we bring, prayers and tears implore thee. Our Father, take the gift we lay, contrite hearts, before thee. Lord, thy sheep have wandered far, gather them before thee. Our Father, let thy shepherd love guide us, we implore thee. Lord, thy pardon grant to all that in truth implore thee. Our Father, let our evening prayer now find grace before thee. Lord, thine humble servants hear, suppliant now before thee. Our Father, from thy children's plea, turn not, we implore thee. I think that the essence of the whole Yom Kippur Day of Atonement has seldom been as crystallized for purposes of prayer as in these seven short stanzas. Sephardic prayer is controlled prayer. It has a definite form, definite meter, definite pattern of organization, a definite set of philosophic presuppositions. Indeed, often Its prayer is nothing but rhymed philosophy, the rhymed philosophy of our faith. They had little use for ecstasy, for enthusiasm, for what we associate religiously with the revival meetings in our own day. When they prayed, they did not shuckle in the sense of weaving back and forward, as if building up for themselves a sense of trance, of exaltation. Their prayer was reasonable and reasoned, dedicated, simple, and sincere, spoken by the heart of the needs of the heart. An education on which all of their thought is based was very dear to their heart. They never built a synagogue if schools needed to be built. The synagogue always had a full program of religious education. Their communities always had an integrated program of education from the earliest childhood to the most advanced training. They would have deeply approved, sincerely approved, of this type of adult institute which we are now engaging in. They knew a great deal about education. I wonder if some of the gradeless excesses of progressive education might not have been avoided if some of our modern educators had known Maimonides. He describes quite brilliantly in a few short paragraphs the psychology of the student, some of the many ways in which good educational practices can be developed. Let us suppose, he writes, that a young boy is brought before a teacher. The purpose of instructing the lad is obviously to enable him to receive knowledge. But the boy is too tender in years and too weak in understanding to appreciate the good which is intended for him and the advantages which he will reap from his progress. Since the teacher is wiser than the boy, he will encourage his pupil to study by offering such things as appear desirable and worthwhile to the child. He will say, "Read and you shall have nuts and figs and honey." And then the little one reads with zest. Not because he finds pleasure in the book or understands that he will be the better for reading it, but because he wants the sweets which have been promised him and which mean more to him than all his studies. When he becomes a little older, these first objects of his desire will appear to him insignificant and contemptible. And if he is to be urged to further effort, he must be offered a greater reward. Then the teacher will say, "Read, and you will be able to earn splendid shoes and magnificent clothes." The prize is tempting, and the boy works hard. Later, the prize is again changed. He is promised a certain amount of money for every lesson that he learns. At last, when he has grown up, these rewards tempt him no longer. And the teacher exhorts him, saying, "Study, and you may become a credit to your community, a president or a judge." Then the young man studies, keeping in view the honor and the glory which he may win for himself. All of this is unworthy, but it is necessary, because the human spirit is narrow, and while acquiring wisdom, hopes for other, more material advantages. In searching for truth, the goal is truth itself. Our sages say, "Blessed is the man who glorifies God and takes pleasure in his commandments, and not in the reward which he might expect." This thought is expressed even more clearly in an early midrash. "Lest you say, 'I will learn Torah so that I may become rich, so that I may become a rabbi, so I may be rewarded in the world to come,' it is written, 'Love your Lord, the Lord your God.' That is all that you should do. That is a reason for your study, out of love to the Lord your God." However, since man is accustomed to act or not to act according to the good or the harm which may result, he loses nothing by shaping his conduct with a view to reward and punishment until, by habit, perception, and ability, he arrives in understanding of the truth and learns to serve purely out of love. We should then not impose upon our children a philosophy of perfection for which they are yet unprepared. We've said that life for the Sephardic Jew, professionally, vocationally, politically, was tumultuous and troubled. This is reflected in his prayer. There is a constant concern with the difficulties of the day. And the Sephardi casts his hopes not upon being able to build for himself a better future, but upon divine intervention. The day when the Messiah will return to the Jews. When Zion...